Kirby Kelly?
Yes.
Very good. Can you state your full name and ABC number for the record?
Mr. Leroy Jackson Jr., 35810.
Thank you, sir. You are appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for 31448 to consider regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. I would like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing with you today. If you can see on your video conference screen, I'll begin with the opposite side of where I'm sitting, looking toward me. On the opposite side, we have the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson. We have the Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse. At the center of the bench, we have our esteemed board chairman, Dr. C.T. Wright. Next to me is the Honorable David Neal. My name is Louis Quinones. I'll be serving as the panel lead for your hearing.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I would like to begin this hearing with a summary. Mr. Leroy Jackson, ADC number 035810, is 65 years old. The crimes of aggravated assault, theft, and rape occurred on or about January 1st, 1976. He was approximately 23 years old at the time of the instant offenses. Does this sound correct so far, Mr. Jackson?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. He was found guilty by jury trial on May 19, 1976, and sentenced to 50 to 100 years for rape on June 16, 1976. The prison terms for aggravated assault and theft have since expired. It should be noted he was granted parole to his next consecutive sentence on December 1st, 1981. And according to Ames, or the information provided to us from the Arizona Department of Corrections, he has a sentence end date of April 3rd, 2024. Again, Mr. Jackson, does that sound correct?
Yes.
He has a limited criminal history, which includes an arrest for theft in 1973. I will read a summary of the current offense in question. On February 1st, 1976, the victim was asleep in her bed, covered with blankets. She was awakened in the early morning hours by Mr. Jackson standing at the head of the bed. As she woke, Mr. Jackson started striking with a metal object, which he described as being brass in color and similar to instruments used by physicians to check reflexes and muscles. She attempted to protect herself and was severely hit several times on the right hand, causing numerous injuries. She was also struck in various places about the head and back of the neck. After being severely beaten, the victim decided to just give up and let Mr. Jackson do what he wished. Mr. Jackson then removed the covers of the bed and completely disrobed, He immediately got on top of the victim who was lying on her back. And again, I'm going to be graphic here, so I apologize to our guests, but this is for the sake of describing the crime. He inserted his erect penis inside his vagina, began the act of sexual intercourse. This lasted approximately 5 minutes. During the act of intercourse, the victim asked Mr. Jackson, "Why me?" He replied, "You had your purse ripped off a while back, and I've been watching you." And again, that's a short version of the offense. There was more investigation to follow. According to Mr. Jackson's institutional progress report, he has had moderate programming in the Arizona Department of Corrections, including sexual offender treatment program in 2008. He has a release plan, which includes living with his fiancée and starting a janitorial business. He's had a significant amount of discipline from 1976 through 2014, with his last major on August 12, 2014, for threatening behavior. This appears to be his 13th hearing before the board. He has no recent letters of support in his parole request packet. We do have a letter dated December 13, 2018, from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, which opposes parole. And in this large package, there may be one that's more recent, but that seemed to be the most recent one that I found. I recognize that there are individuals in the room, Mr. Jackson, and because it's a bit scattered, I want to make sure that I don't offend anyone, because we have both supporters from Mr. Jackson in the room, and we may have victims' representatives as well, correct?
That's correct.
May I ask who's here here on behalf of...
The victim herself is present, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you very much. And again, I do apologize for the graphic description of the crime. So we do have inmates, representatives, inmates, supporters, and victim representatives inside the hearing room today. So, Mr. Jackson, this hearing is another chance for the board to get to know you. Please tell us about the events that resulted in your incarceration and why you think you should be considered for supervised release. Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
I didn't understand what you just said.
I'll say this again. This is another chance for the board to get to know you. So can you tell us about the crime that resulted in you being in prison and why you think you should be considered for supervised release? Does that make sense, sir?
Yes.
Thank you.
The first thing, I did not do the crime, and I've been made my innocent from day one. And since I've been here in this prison, I've just been trying to keep myself together to get out of here, to get back into society and start my life with my fiance and try to blend back in. And it hasn't been no easy road in here either. It's something that I didn't do.
Well, thank you for that summary, Mr. Jackson. And please understand something from my perspective as one board member. I do recognize that there are cases in the correction systems throughout the United States in which people have been wrongly accused. As far as pursuing a retrial, that's handled within the court system. The Arizona Board of Executive Clemency works in the executive branch. So one of my questions is, because there was a lot of information in your board request packet that it looked like an appeal, but I didn't see the cover sheet on it. So did you appeal your case, sir?
Yes, I did.
And what was the result of that appeal?
I was denied.
Okay. And so for the entire time you've been inside the Arizona Department of Corrections, you've claimed your innocence?
Yes, sir.
Are you currently represented by an attorney?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Again, I'm asking that for the sake of your rights. Right now, we do not have an attorney sitting at the front of the hearing room that's representing you, and I just wanted to make sure to allow for that. Do you have any current cases that are still inside the courts right now regarding your case?
No, not at the moment.
Is that something that you intend to do?
Yes, I am. I'm trying to get my money together.
Okay, sir. Again, thank you for being so direct with the board. I'm going to go through some questions. I think you've been reviewing these hearings, but there will come a time where my colleagues will be given an opportunity to ask you questions as well, and then we will open up the hearing for any of your supporters, and then we will hear from victims' representatives. Am I correct that you did go through the sexual offender treatment program in 2008?
Yes.
Well, you're claiming you did not do this crime, so I don't want to put you in a box, so to speak, but was that program useful to you in any way?
Yes, it was.
And how did you find it useful, sir?
Well, it made me understand what life is all about out there in that world. And for something that I didn't do, I took a lot of time into learning it. That way I could speak to other people about their crimes.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. In your release plans, there's a note here that you plan on living with your fiancee.
Yes.
I will ask at this point, although we'll get to that point later in the hearing, is your fiancee in the room today? Is Mr. Jackson's fiancee in the room today? No? Okay. Mr. Jackson, did you think your fiancee was going to be in the room today, here in the hearing room?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, I'm not trying to make that awkward for you, but it is always important when we give them supporters. And you also have a note here that you plan on pursuing work, or pardon me, establishing a janitorial business, sir?
Yes.
And have you gained experience with...
I was brought up on janitorial business as a child. My father had his own business in Phoenix, Arizona.
Thank you, sir. And have you continued that type of work inside the Department of Corrections?
I do it in here, too. I have had a lot of jobs in here.
Mr. Jackson, I do want to credit you for not having any recent discipline, but you have had, well, when I say recent, I mean in the last year or so, but you did have a significant amount of discipline from 1976 through 2014. We have the last major on August 12, 2014. It was shortened, it said, for threatening. So can you explain what happened with that disciplinary action?
Yes, I was in class one day, and the class I was in, me and the teacher never got along. And he heard someone else say something about one of the ladies they got. Earlier over in the East Unit, she got hurt through an attacker, and he said that I made a statement saying that that's what happened to people when they don't listen. And they took me to the warden's office, and he sat down in the warden and talked to both of us, and come to find out the warden knew it was that I didn't make that statement. And I asked him to bring the guy in, that person had made the statement. And he didn't, the teacher did not bring him in. Didn't say who he was, but he kept on saying it was me. And I told him that when he made that type of statement, I was going to class just to go to class. I wasn't going in there trying to hear what everybody else is saying or what they was doing. I was trying to just do me. But for some reason, me and the teacher, we never did get along from day one. But I was in class every day. I just never said nothing to him.
And why did you not get along with your teacher, Mr. Jackson?
Well, he was the type of teacher that wanted you to laugh and play with him, and I'm not that type of person. My job was to go on there and learn how to read and write and just do my class. And I wasn't one of his friends. I've been in here so long where I understand that you don't be a friend. You know, we have to be together for 8 hours, and that's the way I do it. I respect everybody. But at the same time, you know, if a person want to laugh and joke, and I'm there trying to benefit myself, we just never did get along.
Okay, sir. Did you complete your GED inside the Department of Corrections?
No, I didn't.
And I noticed that you're taking the SMART class right now. Are you still in process?
Yes, I am.
And when does that end for you?
Well, it have already ended, but I steady go.
Okay, so...
I don't have anything else to do.
Okay, may I ask my colleagues if they have any questions for you? I have a question for my colleagues. Okay, Mr. Jackson, we're going to continue the hearing by asking if your supporters want to speak. But before anyone speaks today, I do want to know with profound respect, because we operate under the open meeting laws of Arizona. People have a voice in this process, but I'm asking you to try to keep it concise, because we do have a lot of hearings today, and we do have to manage our time. So,
yes.
Can I see a show of hands as to who is going to be speaking on behalf of Mr. Jackson today? Okay, you can come up and whichever one you decide. I'm not going to put a time limit on you. I'm just asking you to be thoughtful about time. Thank you.
Why, what I'm about to tell you about the transcripts is important. resource for each of you.
As an innovative project works and increases natural innocence, it is not justly DNA evidence which can easily exclude a person who may find out it's not their sperm, but they also indicate a variety of other things which have been learned in the process, which today we would call police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, direct burning violations, which do impact on a person's constitutional rights. And I believe that our Bill of Rights is a very precious document. And when I ask people to do, hopefully, in any way, when I speak, is to put themselves in the shoes of any person who's being falsely accused. And what would you want afforded to you? What rights, what opportunities and processes would you want afforded to you? In all fairness, for people to look at something in a truly complete, thoughtful, unbiased manner. So, what I have here first, this book is called Breaking Cotton, and it's written by a friend of mine, Jennifer Thompson. She was a girl from the South, North Carolina, and she did not have black friends. She was raised to be separate, and that is her value in her home and her community. So she was not, according to research, used to looking at facial distinctions carefully. And when one has to come up with sketch artist information or look at photographs in a photographic array, which is a common practice in police and Phoenix also, people who have not had a lot of contact, they don't have black friends, they don't go to church with black people, they don't have organizations or clubs in which they see black people, they don't have co-workers, they don't have contact, you know, daily basis with people, so they do not look at distinctions when they are asked, who is your rapist? Instead, they see black. And the studies, I could show you if we had time, and I am referring to in other citations later, will prove this. And I am asking that this body move towards science-based, fact-based, evidence-based proof of innocence. Science will help Mr. Jackson, as well as best practices for police, best practices for prosecutors, best practices in investigation in general. Innocent people are not going to be accused if we stop pursuing their guilt on the get-go.
Now, I'm going to have to interrupt you, and I just want to make sure that we're clear on this. This is not a court. This
I understand.
So if, once again, I'd say in the beginning, we do need to manage time.
Right. Okay, so I'm referring to on page 11, the case of Jennifer Thompson occurred around 3 a.m., very similar according to the claim of the alleged victim of around 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning. Was also a time when awakening from sleep, people might be somewhat groggy, the perception might be somewhat altered. Page 11 is where that reference is. Page 23, by mid-morning after the rape, Jennifer Thompson, within 8 hours, which is best practice, had managed to get with a sketch artist with the police. A sketch artist asking while you are 8 to 12 hours fresh in your mind is the best way to preserve evidence of who actually committed a crime. Now, if you don't get the sketch artist, if instead you are asked legal questions and suggestive practices of reading a question and making a person think about other things or giving a photographic array in a suggestive manner, research now shows that your perceptions are altered. Jennifer Thompson actually gave a good description of the man who raped her in that first 8 hours. She had best practice. But then, when she went into the police later, they showed her far away. And the man who raped her was not in that far away. Just as the man who was accused of raping Lisa Manning was not in the far away. This shows in research that your flexible, malleable memory is so fragile. There is so much research now showing that you can see the right person at first and know them in any real sketch description, but because of the power of authority, the men wearing uniforms and having guns and believing the policemen and believing the good investigators, you want to believe that they found somebody. And you believe that there must be one way to say something in a certain way or go and get a lamp in a certain direction. And so, General Thompson's memories shifted. And the nightmare she started having were a man named Robert Cotton, who actually was innocent.
Ma'am, I'm going to ask you to sum this up. We don't have a moment in time.
I understand. And this may be that we will need to go in segments. 6 months from now, I'll come and I'll give more detailed references and have some research to show you. I can also, in the future, 6 months or 12 months, I can go through and show on this date, these were the alleged victim statements. On this date, this is how they changed and shifted a different version, and the five different things that were said, which were in conflict, were inconsistent, and they could not all have been true at the same time. And so again, under cross-examination, the new transcripts, if you read the transcripts of this original trial, Michael Green's the public defender, he was a good public defender. And he did object to a number of points and he cross-examined and brought an admission of knowing that wasn't the way it was. There were a number of things that needed to be brought before court to prove this man's innocent at length. This is not that body, but it is, if you're making a decision about listening to someone, then we might also need to look into research on eyewitness misidentification and the power of suggestive forgery, because that is exactly what happened in Jennifer Thompson's case, and I do believe that it was also objected to and it was tried to be blamed by his, Mr. Green, the public defender for Mr. Jackson. It was also brought up in his appeal. You asked at that time in the majority of my story for a guilty verdict on appeal. And frankly, I was shocked that you did not remember going back to 1976, because this man has been 43 years. Granted, this body is not the same group of people that were the jury when he was arrested. Nor is this body interviewing the same body that looked at him for commutation of the government in 1992, 94, 95, and recommended him up through phase two because he had an excessive sentence. Now, it isn't maybe it's readily available, I grant you, when I went to his file, it was at least 3 rows thick. At least 1,200 to 1,500 pages in Mr. Jackson's file. But if you've been in prison 43 years, you might have a file that large also, if you were attending to prove your innocence the entire time.
Well, would you please just sum it up? We're giving for interrupting, but we must move on. So if you would just take another minute and sum up whatever you need to tell the board,
I would
certainly appreciate it.
I have copies here of his file. You said you don't have any letters that were recent. There were 12 people here in October 2017. His family came. You said that you certainly couldn't say that he didn't have a plan because he had support letters from Tiger Mountain Foundation, which I can give you if you want me to give you a copy of all of those.
If they were presented, they are already in the record, if they were presented at that time.
They were presented.
Then they're in the files.
No, I said the reason that for this hearing, we have letters of support in this spot.
And you had no reason to check a box that you were not have support systems in place, because there were clearly 12 people who were at that hearing with letters of support, saying that they would support him, including the nonprofit, providing counseling, housing, job support, and so on for them. What I do have here also, though, if I give you a copy of his entire appeal, which included an amicus brief, the ACLU in 1976 came to his rescue. They came to his rescue saying, this is a disproportionate sentence. It is racially disproportionate.
Now, I am going to interrupt at this point. We keep asking you to sum this up, A, and B, what I said in the beginning is we had a lot of information that looks like an appeal, it just didn't have a cover sheet on it. There's lots of legal information in here. But you talked about the ACLU coming to his rescue. He's still in the prison system. He was not granted his appeal. We have to take the information that's provided to us by the courts in good faith. That's why I said we're not the courts. We take the information at this point, we look at the totality of the case and where the individual is at in the development side of the Department of Corrections. So, I am open-minded. I am an open book about each individual that appears before this board, but you're monopolizing time right now. So I'm going to ask you to bring this to a close.
I know it wasn't easy to get a hold of the appeal. I had to go into the archives of the appeals court. I had to take my camera, my little digital camera, take photographs, download them, because every single photograph on microfiche was brittle and yellowed. And that was the only record that I could find. And so if you do have a copy of the entire thing, that's great. I will present you a copy each day, but I only with the understanding that you're going to have to use this resource carefully, or go out to the archives yourself and look at the entire microfiche, 180 pages and 170 pages for the opening brief and the details. And it is detailed, but they made a good case. The fact that he did not win his appeal does not mean that he did not make a valid case. It states in the GPC Articles 2 that it said his appeal was at issue, quote, at issue, which meant that really was prone to go over with a petition for review to the Arizona Supreme Court and the Supreme Court. What happened is a tragic
matter. Would you please just listen to us and let us move on, please, ma'am?
Well, this is true.
So if you have something to present, why don't you go ahead and present that to the board, and we will review it. I'm not going to say what the results would be, because each one of us are independent of each other. We're not together. We're independent of each other. We cannot discuss it among each other, but we will review it at some point in time, and this will be a part of the record. This will be a part of the record, so we certainly appreciate it.
This is his appeal.
Okay, thank you so much.
And if you can reference it for future hearings,
this will be a part of
this body. It's important that we go back, because
yes, ma'am.
I would actually read.
We appreciate it. Yes, ma'am.
I would read that in this brief. Give me the opportunity later.
We appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Quinones?
Yes.
I just want to put a couple of things on record, because Dr. Wright and myself in October, when this was here, were both here at the trial. It's on the record, and Dr. Wright and myself both voted on it. I was the lead on it, and we did not mark that there was we didn't mark anything about it not having family support.
The other thing is, you didn't recuse yourselves either.
That's what I just wanted to make clear. Okay.
Well, we're not sure that. Thank you so very much.
Right. Ma'am, I think we need to move on to our next.
Right. And so I would encourage you to have these and keep them as references and resources for future hearings, in which I will go into detail about the specifics of why I believe that Mr. Jackson is innocent and that the alleged victim was truly not credible.
And you made yours very clear, so thank you, ma'am. Thank you so very much.
I was just given a short notification of the board recording, and I want to be clear on this. I may have been a bit liberal in the interpretation as to how long inmate supporters can speak, but I'm going to ask you please limit it to 5 minutes because we need room for the victim's representatives, and they needed the full amount of time necessary to speak before this board. Thank you, sir.
I shouldn't take more than that. My name is David Wells. I'm a professor at Arizona State University. I teach political science there. Some of my students are here. I'm also the research director for the nonprofit Grand Canyon Institute, which is a centrist think tank, and we've done some work related to criminal justice reform. I'm also a Quaker, which is how I got to know Lucinda through this case. I've only been aware of this case for a couple of years. With the Grand Canyon Institute, we're currently involved in some research related to death penalty cases and the sentences that result from cases that began with death penalties. What's clear here, I mean, obviously, you probably can't assume that he's innocent or not. My understanding is that his the DNA evidence has been destroyed by the Phoenix, so it's actually he's not able to exonerate himself in that way, which is unfortunate. But it's quite clear to me that somebody who's been in prison for 43 years is a grossly disproportionate sentence. It's a travesty of justice that somebody would be in prison this long. I can go through, we have a database of all these people who have committed some heinous murders. Not all have been sentenced to life in prison, but there's somebody who has a similar case, for instance, which is which involved somebody who was an ex-girlfriend who was beaten to death and eventually convicted of second-degree murder and received a 22-year sentence. That's half the amount of time that Mr. Jackson has been in prison. It seems, you know, regardless of whether you consider him to be innocent or he has committed a crime, he's gone way above and beyond it. And to me, as a taxpayer, it's quite disconcerting to me to think that we're going to be spending $20,000 a year to put this poor gentleman behind bars when we could use that money to help put kids to make sure they graduate from high school. We do lots of other things to help prevent future crimes from occurring or help victims. And I've been a victim. Unfortunately, my daughter was murdered 4 years ago. So I have been on that side as well. So I just would hope that you would sort of realize that this is a travesty of justice, is something that can't continue to go on. I'll be continuing to look into this case, and I really appreciate your time, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, sir. Can you state your name?
My name is Len Schultz.
And what would you like to share with the board, sir?
I will be brief, and I'd like to go through basically hell to earth that happened today with the board. So we'll start with hell. Let's assume, as some of you may, that the justice system at the time Leroy was convicted is fair. Let's assume that he committed a crime and that it was brutal and that it was evil and that he did all these things. So if we assume hell right now, what do we got? We got Leroy served plenty of time at this point in time for the crime that he committed. He served 43 years in prison, right? He has had good behavior throughout his stay. He's been shown that he's been willing to work within the system, even though he's always pled innocence. But even if he was guilty, right, he was throughout this time had good behavior within the system. And finally, even if he committed this act, at this point in time, for how much time he served, the public out here does not want to be putting him behind bars at this point. There's no vested interest in having a man of this age, this amount of time in prison. Okay, so now it's the earth. All right.
right, so as we all know, throughout the decades, systematic biases have been revealed within the system in terms of the racist components within the police and judicial system. And so, one thing we need to definitely keep in mind, and I encourage the board to keep in mind, is that for many of the plaintiff innocents who locked in on his own free will, he was convicted at a time when just a few years prior, black and white people couldn't go to the same schools. They couldn't make from the same income level. And so think that all the systematic racial biases disappeared in just a few short years is naive. Now this doesn't assume we got wrong. We're not assuming he was perfect. We're not assuming he was evil necessarily. But we can assume that we know, because it exists in our present time, these racial biases, that back in those days, the biases were worse, the racism were worse, and that is what was part of all the evidence that is against him, stems from this past system that we have to be very careful of. Next up, let's just consider, just on a strategic point of view, if a man had pled innocent and he wasn't getting anywhere and he's been in prison for 43 years, he would have done better now to have just said, to feign guilt for the crime he didn't commit, and then said, I'm sorry, I repent of it, I reformed myself. Even just strategically, that would be a better move, even if he hadn't committed the crime. But he hasn't done that. And you're going to ask yourself, why hasn't he repented and, you know, feigned guilt at this point? The only reason, even though he probably didn't have a prison sooner, the only reason I can see is that the man's conscience won't let him do it. So that brings us to heaven. So let's think about what's happened here. We have a man who walked into the police station at the age of 22, who turned himself in,
and he's always pled innocent with his mic issue. But I'll continue. Just let's consider the earth and heavenly accountability that rests upon putting this man into a guilty state after always pleading innocence. That rests upon you to potentially put a man behind bars and confine an innocent man just that much further. So, with that, I thank you for your time. I hope you will consider the weight of the decision you're making today. Thank you.
Sir, one second. I just want to make sure that there are any questions from fellow board members. No questions. Thank you. You made a very compelling and concise piece there, so thank you. Any further supporters for Mr. Jackson at this point? Okay, then I'd like to move along with the victim's representatives and the victim. So how, what order would you like to move forward? Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you state your name, please?
My name is Lisa Malin. I am proudly 65 years of age. I have two amazing, productive, loving, grown sons. And I have a full and very gratifying wife. I could address Mr. Jackson's supporters' comments, but I would rather take my time to just address the panel. The case we are all speaking about started in February 1976. Yes, 43 years is a very long time ago. I remember that night very well, along with the days, weeks, months, and years after that night, as I dealt with being the victim of rape, brutal beating, and robbery. I awoke in the middle of the night on February 1st, 1976, to inmate Jackson standing over my bed. He had a tool in his hand and proceeded to beat me before and after raping me. He gagged me with a sock and tied a second long sock around my mouth to the back of my head. He hog-tied me with a cord from a bedside lamp. He then proceeded to steal everything of any value or importance from my apartment. He made many trips to his car, filling it with my life's valuables, and each time before and after filling his car, he made sure to beat me again and again. Within days of that horrible night, I was called to the Phoenix police station, where I provided direct identification evidence. There was also a fingerprint found on the bedside lamp in my apartment. There was blood, my blood, found on Mr. Jackson's jacket. In June of that year, Mr. Jackson was found guilty by a jury of rape, grand theft, and aggravated battery. Judge Hyneman, bless him, handed down a very stiff, but obviously, in his mind, a fair sentence. I want to quote a part of a letter that Cindy Nanetti wrote in 1995 when a disproportionality hearing was conducted. At that time, Cindy was chief of the Sex Crimes Bureau at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. She said, and I quote, "Mr. Jackson's sadistic, sexual, and physical offending behavior show his problems are much greater than deviant arousal and social skill deficiencies. He is a predator who inflicts immeasurable terror on his victims. Despite overwhelming evidence that he assaulted Ms. M., he denied his culpability." Unquote. I refer to this quote to point out that Mr. Jackson's behavior is why he was given a sentence of 65 to 115 years. And his behavior in prison for the last 43 years is why he should not be released before the mandatory release date. We are not here to discuss whether Mr. Jackson committed a crime. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I identified him in a lineup. His fingerprint was found on my lamp, my blood was found on his jacket, and a jury quickly found him guilty on all counts. Today's hearing is about whether inmate Jackson should be released before his mandatory release date. Should he be released early? Shall he be released out into a world where taking responsibility is a tenet of our freedoms? This begs the question, if inmate Jackson were to be released now, would he be the same person he was 43 years ago? Let me point out three important considerations. Has inmate Jackson taken responsibility for what he did to me 43 years ago? Has inmate Jackson taken responsibility for improving his life while in prison all these years? Has inmate Jackson taken responsibility to prepare for life outside of prison? In other words, has inmate Jackson taken responsibility for anything in all of these 43 years? Let's examine these three considerations in detail. He's never admitted to committing any crimes, even though there was sufficient evidence for a jury to convict him of rape, grand theft, and aggravated battery, and for the judge to sentence him to a total of 65 to 115 years. Mr. Jackson has chosen to not take responsibility for his actions. Jackson has stated in previous hearings that he has not attended classes while in prison, or if he has, he has not completed any of the treatment programs. So again, Mr. Jackson has chosen to not take responsibility for bettering his life while in prison for 43 years. By not having therapy or completing any treatment programs, how could he have made changes in his thinking, in his attitude towards women, and in his behavior in general? How can we expect him to know how to be a decent human being in our world outside of prison walls? He has not prepared himself for life on the outside. Again, Mr. Jackson has chosen to not take responsibility. Today is my fourth appearance before this board over the last 4 years. In every one of the hearings I've attended, this board has come to the same conclusion, and I'm paraphrasing, that inmate Jackson has made a choice to not take responsibility for his actions or made any improvements to his life, and the board denied his release. Please tell me what is different this time. I am not a vindictive person. I feel for Mr. Jackson's family. Of course they want him out of prison, and I understand why they want to believe he should be released now. I would rather not be here myself. The cost of attending these hearings and the emotional toll involved in appearing before this board is considerable. I hate that I have to emotionally visit this horrible event every 6 months now. I completely agree that 43 years in prison is a very long time. However, I will continue to be reminded of that horrible night in 76, and I will continue to be in attendance before this board because it is not right that inmate Jackson be released early. He does not deserve to be released before his mandatory release date. I ask you to think about the life you have lived over the last 43 years. You have worked hard to create and sustain a productive life. You have made choices that allowed you to get to this point in your life, to be chosen by the governor to be on this board. You have enjoyed freedom as a result of hard work and choices you've made through the years. In order to have a civilized society, we all work hard and we take responsibility for the choices we've made. Mr. Jackson has not taken responsibility for anything over the last 43 years. Tell me why he should be allowed any freedom. Thank you.
Well, just a quick question, and again, I've stated, as I've stated many times as a member of this board, that we're not the courts. Sometimes it feels like the courts inside this room based on the way we run our hearings, but I did want to ask you, it's more of a curiosity, and that is, having gone through the criminal justice system, was attempted murder ever considered as one of the charges?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm sorry for such a long question. Any questions
you want to ask? He did threaten to kill me, but that was not one of the charges.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any questions? Thank you for appearing before this board.
Good morning. My name is Sarah McClicker, and I'm a prosecutor at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. I've appeared in front of this board related to this hearing and others in the past. You also see letters on behalf of my office that I've written and signed as well. So I appreciate your time. I will be brief, and I'm happy to answer any questions the board may have that I may have the ability to answer for you. I am not going to rehash what has been stated previously. Again, I have been here before on this case numerous times. I do want to clarify a couple of things. I know the inmate in this matter indicated that he did sex offender treatment while in custody. He has not completed that treatment. And so as far as we're concerned, he is not a treated sex offender, certainly in a position to be released out into the community at this point. And I will tell you, assuming this was a different case, assuming he was in a position where he was going to be released to the community on probation, for example, which is typical and in sex offender cases, they would then be placed on sex offender treatment once out in the community. He would not be admitted into any treatment program that is legitimate without actually admitting to the underlying offense. And so this is an inmate who, at this point, a person who continues to deny his underlying offense, is an untreated sex offender and an untreatable sex offender at this point. And so based on that, we believe he to be in increased risk to the community and should not be released. I would also point out that there were some mentions from his supporters about his behavior and how he's been a model inmate. The board knows that it's just, in fact, incorrect. He's had, I believe, over 50 infractions while in custody. The incident that the board mentioned related to the threatening, the major violation, it appears to me and my office that his behavior was consistent with what it is in this particular case, in which he is denying responsibility for those actions in which they were threatening in nature. He indicated to you this morning that the warden didn't believe that he engaged in such behavior, and yet he was still given a major violation. So it is inconsistent from the evidence that it appears there was. And so, again, his consistent need to deny is something that is additionally concerning for any kind of turnaround or rehabilitation, and also concerning for his risk to the community at this point. There was talk about this being a grossly disproportionate sentence, and I know that has been something that this board has questioned over the years. I would say it's not. We have statutes in place that allow for very significant sentences for sex offenders and for individuals committing crimes such as these. Violent sexual assault is a case in which people are given life sentences. So this is not completely out of the norm. While this body may see sexual assault cases on adults that tend to have lower sentences maybe over the last number of years, there is certainly a law in place that allows for life sentences on cases with facts similar to this, in which there was such a heinous and violent assault that occurred amongst the sexual acts that occurred as well. I know there was also talk about the fact that murderers get less time. That is a discussion that happens in our court system on a regular basis. That is the very nature of how the laws here in Arizona are, and we all have to live within those laws. The legislature has decided to treat sex offense cases very significantly, and we have to rely on the fact that our legislatures have made appropriate decisions, and should there be discussion or argument or dispute with the way the laws have been written, then people should go to the legislature and make the argument there. This is not, frankly, the body for that. This is the body to determine if the defendant, the inmate in this case, has been given a disproportionately lengthy sentence, which we don't believe he has, based on the underlying facts of this case, and whether he was is a risk to the community should he be released early. And I want to stress that, and I know the victim in this case, Ms. Mellon, indicated that as well. This is a request for early release. The court determined how long he should serve that sentence for, and it doesn't appear from his record that he has done anything to earn any exception to that sentence by getting an early release. While it is something he is given the right to ask for, it doesn't appear as though he has earned it based on the behaviors or comments that he has made up until this point. So for all of those reasons, we are still in a position where we are objecting to his release at this time, and I'm happy to answer any questions the board may have. Otherwise, I will have a seat and close this up for you. Yes, sir.
In the pre-sentence report, it repeatedly refers to considerable evidence, but it doesn't specifically state evidence. So my question to you is, was there a fingerprint found on the lamp inside of her apartment?
That is my understanding. My understanding is that there was a fingerprint found that was inconsistent with this inmate's fingerprints. It's also my understanding that clothing was later located. Either, I believe, with the defendant, this inmate's family members. I believe his sister is my memory. Ms. Mellon can speak better to that. But she showed up to court wearing one of her jackets. So the clothing, the items that were stolen from the victim in this case on the night of the incident was later found to have been basically in the inmate's possession and or his family member's possession based on him providing it to them. I would also point out that identification and testimony of a victim is evidence, and in this case, it is strong evidence and was strong evidence. Ms. Mallon very clearly indicated that this inmate and no other, there was never a hesitation, that this inmate is the individual who violently sexually assaulted her and burglarized her home. And even to this day, I know in previous clemency board hearings, she has been asked a question similar to that, and she has indicated 100% she still believes to this day, and looking at the person in the video who was on the TV screen, that he is the person that committed this offense. And so, in addition to all of the evidence that was presented at trial, she continues to this day to be firm in her conviction of what she knows to be true.
With my years of doing different kinds of investigations, it's I understand the issues about eyewitnesses and unreliability of identification and everything else. But this is a case where not only is there a strong identification by the victim, there's supporting evidence to her identification.
Correct.
So even if a judge said we'll throw her identification out because we don't trust it, there's still other evidence that indicates that he is the culprit in this case, right?
I would agree with that. I think it is what we would call neutral, objective evidence in which it could not have come from any bias place, in that there is a fingerprint and then there were items that were located that were basically in the defendant's possession, in the inmate's possession, that were taken in this case. So I would agree with that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. I just wanted to go in the pre-sentence report. It says that there were two other sexual assault cases that he was identified in, those two other sexual assault cases, as well as a third one, and which the MO was the same, but the victim was unable to identify him, and the county attorney's office chose not to prosecute those other cases, that it would be a waste of taxpayers' money to go ahead and prosecute them on those when they already had this case with the fingerprints and the other evidence, as well as the identification in it.
I read the same thing. I specifically have that page pulled up. It's page 3 in the pre-sentence report that references those other victims. Again, he has not been convicted of those crimes.
Right.
And my office recognizes that, which is why I haven't spent time concentrating on that information. However, I believe it is important for the board to be aware of that information. The detective in this case, back at the time that this inmate was convicted of the case in which we're here on today, indicated that the defendant did commit other sexual assaults with very similar, if not almost identical, behavior. But it appears as though at the time that the Maricopa County Attorney's Office determined it was unnecessary to proceed in basically putting additional victims through the process of a trial, as well as it seems as though there was some discussion of financial issues in proceeding with prosecution in those cases. But I would also encourage the board to not ignore those facts. Things may be done differently in today's world. We may not we drop another case because one is proceeding. We just don't know what's going to happen down the road with appeal rights and things like that. But again, to put a victim through the process of a trial, and then, as you can see, 40-something years of the potential of their offender being released into the community is significant. And so we do what we can in my office to avoid putting victims through what we would describe as a re-traumatization, unless it is necessary and appropriate in the interest of justice. In this case, it appears as though, and I can only guess, that the prosecutors that were involved at the time determined that this inmate was going to be going away for basically a life term. And so why put additional victims through this process? Had they known, perhaps, that there was a potential for him to be released at this point with the continued denial of his offense, perhaps they would have proceeded on the other charges to have consecutive sentences. I cannot speculate because I was not involved in those cases, but I would agree with the board member that it is accurate that the information we have is that there is evidence to show he committed additional crimes similar, if not almost exactly the same, to the crime we have here.
Just a quick follow-up question, ma'am. I think it's always inflammatory when an individual makes a statement like the police destroyed the evidence. Was evidence destroyed in this case?
I have no information to believe that there was any evidence destroyed. I think there was some discussion about DNA. I think that's what it was in reference to. I will tell you that over the last year, my office has been contacted to see if we would agree to any DNA that is around and available to be tested up against the inmate's own DNA at this point, and we did not object to that testing. We're in the business of providing answers to what really happens, and so we are not objecting to that type of testing being done. I don't know what the results were in that, whether they went to the lab and they determined that there was no DNA left. There are many different reasons why that could happen. One, after a very large number of years, some evidence is destroyed. At the lab, that is possible, but it does. We do have statutes that mandate that they do not destroy evidence in one's sexual assault cases for a significant period of time. I don't recall the exact length at this point as I stand here. But also, there are situations in which there's just not enough that can be provided to be tested, because you certainly have to have a certain amount of a substance, of a sample, to be able to do a complete testing for DNA analysis. So I am not aware of any evidence, as I stand here today, of being destroyed. I know there was reference to that. But again, let's just assume, for argument's sake, that evidence has been destroyed between the day of crime and today. What I spoke with Mr. Neal about earlier is that there is still significant evidence in this case that I don't think can be disputed.
My only point was there's a big difference between simply destroyed and purged, because I'm a retired federal agent. I know about purging evidence after a certain amount of years, and we've been through the system and it's over and done with. We don't keep the evidence forever. So I wasn't quite sure if the evidence had been purged, or if there had been a fire, or if someone was alleging that evidence was illegally destroyed.
What I'll tell you is I've never heard that allegation until today. The word destroyed was used. I understood it to mean potentially purged. So I understand the way I believe that you are hearing it. I am not aware of any evidence in this particular case that was destroyed either willfully or by some kind of accident. It would only, if it does not exist, I would say it's either because there's not enough to do additional testing, not sufficient sample, or it potentially was purged because of the number of years that have passed, which is certainly possible in case.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Any further information from our victims' advocates? Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Jackson, I recognize there's been a lot of discussion here in the hearing room, but we are meeting near the end of your hearing. So, is there a final statement you would like to make to the board before we go into discussion? We really ask that you don't repeat anything that you've already told us, but this is your hearing. So the question is there anything else that you feel is important for us to know or understand before this board deliberates and votes on this case? Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Yeah, first I would like to thank everybody for coming to speak on my behalf. I'd like to thank them very much. And the only thing I can really say about the board is, to the board, is that you heard both sides and I heard both sides. And I'm not the man that they say that I was. I'm not the one that did this crime. And like I said, I got evidence to prove that I didn't do it. So, that's about all I have to say. And I appreciate y'all for letting me show up at your board. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson, and thank you for being so pleasant with the board today. The board will be going into discussion now. It may sound like that we're speaking with you directly, but it is the board discussing the case amongst itself under the open meeting laws of Arizona. So if you'll just remain on the phone, we'll come back to you shortly with our decision. Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
You're welcome.
The board is now in discussion. For the board members, personally, I think these types of cases are always challenging. and recognize, as I stated in the very beginning, the reality inside correction systems throughout the United States, that there are people that have been wrongly accused. But I looked at the whole of the case as well, and when we received large amounts of data, certainly a couple of factors, not the only factors, but a couple of factors I looked at, was whether the case had been appealed, sometimes it had been all the way through the Supreme Court, whether that individual was up for retrial, whether the cases continued to be pursued by the courts, and that's just a couple of the factors in looking at everything. So I will state that I take the information that's provided to this board at face value, that the individual was convicted, had appealed his case, and as the opinion of one voting member of this board, I do not embrace that simply because an individual states for a long period of time that they didn't do it does not mean that they're not guilty of the crime. Certainly there are people who can state that for many, many, many years inside the Department of Corrections and stick to the story, so to speak. I don't know what is in that person's heart and mind. What I do know is that they were found guilty in the courts, that they appealed their case, and the case was affirmed. So, taking this case at face value, I have to say that based on the heinous and extremely violent nature of the crime, also that this crime is an escalation of violence, and the fact that Mr. Jackson has had a major violation inside the Department of Corrections within the last 5 years, which we consider recent, I have concerns as to whether supervised release would serve the interest of justice, but that's where I'll begin the discussion. Yes, I'm sorry.
And I have to agree, one of my responsibilities that we have too is also to try to ensure that there's a reasonable likelihood that the offender won't go back out and recommit. And we also have to take into consideration the overall general public. And because in this particular instance, there are other cases where he has been identified as being involved in sexual assaults in the MO, and they were violent and heinous in the ways that they were committed. I think it's important for us to take into consideration that when someone is released, that at least that we feel comfortable to a degree that that person would not go back out and reoffend, and that the public itself would be safe in that environment. In this particular case, I remember hearing it before, and I don't feel particularly comfortable that, you know, the defendant would not go back out and reoffend, and that the it's in the best interest for the protection of the public to be incarcerated. I'm not in agreement at this time of granting a parole to Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other comments? Yes, Mr. Neal.
Yes, as far as, you know, who committed the crime, the majority of what's been talked about today on Mr. Jackson's side has things that are very, 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 very subjective. And although science may say it doesn't, that science can't pinpoint an individual that takes a lot of people, a lot of cases, and it's like, well, this is the tendency. And I understand that can help as we go on, but a fingerprint and other evidence, silent evidence like that, it's hard to walk away thinking that he absolutely did not commit that crime. But I was going to say that there was a mention of drugs back in those days. There had been some arrest or violation of going on, but it was possible that he got high and really doesn't remember the crime.
motion both ways, and I agree, we're not the court system, we're not the appeal court, we're not the Supreme Court, but we have to rely on the information we've gotten from the court decisions. And this is a jury trial, there was enough evidence to convince the jury that Mr. Jackson was the perpetrator. The victim was very adamant about being the perpetrator. And everything that I've been presenting, and I was doing on the last hearing, which was a late hearing, and that one may be the one that people are referencing, no family or community support, because the late hearing, no one was here. But I have to accept that what the court said in jury trial being upheld and on appeal, and then for whatever reason it wasn't taken beyond that. So I'm not comfortable with the idea of releasing him at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newell. Can we go ahead and look for Michael?
Thank you, Mr. Gomez. I think that the board has to be very careful in whatever decision that it makes, and I think that those who are present, they must realize that this is not a court of law. You know, and I think that some of the issues that were raised this morning would have been more appropriate if they would be an appeal in a court of law rather than coming before this board. But that's neither here nor there. Would Jackson be a threat to society? One of the things that concerned me about him, what I've heard this morning, and this is the sixth time that I've heard him, or been a part of this whole process, is that he tends not to complete anything. And that concerns me. He admits himself, he did not complete the GED. He had an opportunity after all of these years, still not completed. We also take note that he, for some reason, after a while, he did not continue to appeal this case. Initially, he did appeal, and I commend him for that because that's his legal rights. After a while, he just didn't go any further. I think that we have to take into consideration both sides, that of Mr. Jackson as well as the victim. I think that we've heard information today as we've heard in the past. I don't see any reason after six times to grant him any type of release at this time. I think that he's put forward the best that he had, and we appreciate everybody who's come to support him. And I just want to say this before I turn it back over to you, sir. Once this hearing is over, those of you who are here to support him, please exit this door. Those who are here victims, please use this door. Please. And let each of us, once this board has voted, act in a professional way and not get upset, because don't care what we do, we can't please everybody in the room. But I'm not in favor at this time.
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Board Chair. I'm going to go ahead and make a motion, and that is regarding Mr. Leroy Jackson, ADC number 035810. My motion is to deny revenue parole, absolute discharge, and home arrest. And based on the other crime, we have no mechanism for a 1-year setoff. And that is my motion.
Second.
Agree. Seconded by the Honorable Mr. Moore, agreed upon by the Honorable Dr. Wright. Dealt with Mr. Johnson, dealt with Ms. Gail Rittenhouse. As I stated, we have no mechanism for a 1-year setoff. Release type denied, 412A411HA, which is to say regular parole, absolute discharge, home arrest. Reasons for denial are as follows: serious and violent offense, serious and deviant offense, trauma to the victim, serious bodily injury, victim harassment, based on the way the crime was committed, with him returning to the residence and continued threats is the way it was described. His prior criminal history. Recent
disciplinary infraction that is disabled in the last 5 years. And is there anything else that any of my fellow board members wish to add? Okay, Mr. Jackson, the board voted unanimously to deny the deferral of absolute discharge of home arrest. You will be certified by the Arizona Department of Corrections to appear before this board again in approximately 6 months. We do appreciate you being so pleasant with the board, and so please continue with your programming inside the DOC. Please stay safe. This will bring our hearing to conclusion. Thank you for all board members.
Thank you.